Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we speak with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill to try to better understand why his office last week announced that it would not pursue charges against a police sergeant who in 2019 shot and killed a man being held handcuffed inside of a West Valley City police station. I should say that this conversation describes violence that some listeners may find disturbing. I spoke with the district attorney on Wednesday. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
You recently released your determination on the legality of a police shooting that happened just about 2 years ago. On August 23rd, 2019, West Valley City Police Sergeant Taylor Longman shot and killed Michael Chad Breinholt inside the West Valley City Police Station. Police had arrested Breinholt after they received a call saying he had taken a lot of pills. Breinholt had told his girlfriend that he'd taken the pills to die. Police brought him in on a DUI, and while they were holding him, Breinholt was saying that he wanted to go to a psychiatric hospital. He had his hands cuffed behind his back, and eventually, after nearly 2 hours, he started saying that he had a gun. First, he said that it was in his clothes. Then he said it was in his shoe. He had been searched, but one of the officers decided to look at his shoes anyway, and at that point, a scuffle broke out. An officer shouted, "He's got my gun," and then Sergeant Longman entered the room and said, "You're about to die, my friend," before shooting Breinholt in the head. You ruled that shooting to be legally justified and as a result said that you would not be pursuing charges against Officer Longman, Sergeant Longman. How, Sim Gill, is the shooting of a man in custody with his hands cuffed behind his back, how is that legally justified?
Certainly. And I think it's important to make the distinction, right? There are two expectations that we have legitimately. When you're looking at it from the outside, in a most generic, general sense, there is a sense of moral outrage. And what we want to make sure that, because I have an opinion on whether it's morally justified versus whether it's legally justified. So I think it's important to make those distinctions. So the legal justification is that in the state of Utah, like in most states around the country, that officers, law enforcement, is authorized to use fatal force, lethal force, under certain circumstances, and they are given, if those circumstances are met, an affirmative defense of justification. That means they get to say, within the four corners of this law that the statute, the state legislature has created, my actions were within those four corners. Therefore, the prosecution is precluded as a matter of affirmative defense from going forward. And so when we look at officer-involved critical incident, I cannot absolve myself away from that statute that's there. And in this case, one of the things that is allows officer to use lethal force is if they fear for their personal safety, mm-hmm. Or the safety of another person. So that's one of the prongs. So and then the question then becomes, it's not just the subjective belief of that officer, but how does that subjective belief at the time that he or she pulls the trigger coincide with the objective reality? Not how we got there, which is a separate part of an analysis, but not for the purposes of the legal analysis. Hmm. So in this case, you're right. We had somebody who was in state custody, who was in crisis, who was intoxicated. So when we looked at the video evidence and when we looked, and Longman says, he gave us an interview and he said, when I heard Officer Atkins say, "He's got my gun," I rushed in and I was concerned that we were in a tight space. This guy has the gun of a police officer, and if that gun comes out, it is going to injure him or me or other officers. I was fear of my safety and the safety of other people. Now, what, you and I can argue whether that was a valid belief or not, but that's what he's articulating. So now the next question becomes, is that a reasonable belief within the factual circumstances and the totality of those circumstances at that moment? Certainly, Officer Atkins says, I saw this guy grab my gun and he's tugging it up and I've got my full force trying to keep it in my holster. Officer Wilhelm, who's also in there, says that I've been working with Officer Atkins and there was a voice of panic and urgency. Longman says there was a voice of panic and urgency in Atkins' voice as well. So this is what the evidence is going to bring. And at that point, was Longman unreasonable in his belief. And if I say that he was unreasonable because I want to charge him, then I have to prove that he was unreasonable beyond a reasonable doubt in the circumstances in order to be able to carry my burden and for him to be not able to have the affirmative defense of justification as articulated in the state of Utah. Furthermore, we also retained two experts who also looked at the same thing and said that in their professional opinion, in the context of the situation, Sergeant Longman's belief was not unreasonable and that it was reasonable to fear for his safety or the safety of others. Therefore, he was justified in the use of lethal force under the affirmative statute. So I would have to then go into court to disprove these two experts. I would have to go and disprove the two witness officers. I would have to go and disprove the belief of Sergeant Longman and all of that beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the burden that the law imposes upon me. So legally justified.
I mean, I think that some listeners will say, who gets to make the determination as to what a reasonable belief is? Because, you know, having watched the video, there's a guy who's his hands cuffed behind his back. Is it reasonable to believe that when he has the gun, he's going to do harm with it?
Right. In the popular vernacular, we would think about a reasonable person. But when it comes to officer-involved shooting, the Supreme Court has said that it is what a reasonable officer would do under those circumstances. Not just a reasonable person, but what a reasonable police officer in a similar situation would do, right? And I outline these things not necessarily because I agree with them, because my position has always been that if we want different outcomes, we need to change the law.
Right.
And as the public policymakers have created the law, it disproportionately favors one side over the other side's expectations. And I've said that reform is equalizing that, right? So under what conditions do we get to use the affirmative defense of justification? It's right now a really wide net that's cast that covers pretty much everything. And it is theoretically possible to prosecute a police officer, but it pragmatically and probabilistically not very likely to, because in order to meet the conditions under the current statute is such a narrow set of circumstances that you have to meet. So I have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
What about the idea of, you know, prosecutorial discretion? Are there instances, is that something that you can or ever do use? And then yeah, again, I have these emails from listeners who say this wasn't reasonable. Why not use prosecutorial discretion in this instance?
So that's a valid point. So the question then becomes, I also take an oath to apply the law, and that is the same law that is going to judge the outcome of this. So let's go through a thought experiment. Let's say that I find every officer-involved shooting that comes up more or less unjustified, okay? And I exercise my discretion to file the charges. Once that I do that, chances of me surviving preliminary hearing are nil or nearly impossible. Then this last legislative session, House Bill 227 got passed, which says that anybody who raises the issue of self-defense, which in this case, when most officer-involved shootings are because they were in fear of their life, hence self-defense, then if I survive the prelim, then I have to go to a motion hearing and convince the judge by clear and convincing evidence that the defense of justification is not applicable. And if I fail to do so, the judge shall, not may, shall throw the case out with prejudice. And then let's say if I even prevail at that moment, then I go to a jury, they still get to raise the same issue of self-defense. And I cannot point back to the fact that I met my burden by clear and convincing evidence, because I'm precluded from doing that. And then I have to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that it was unreasonable for this officer to be in fear of their life, right?
Or harm to others.
Or harm to others.
You are an elected official. You are a political person also, in addition to being someone who is upholding the letter of the law. And I'm wondering if you might, in some instances, just choose to prosecute anyway as a way of sending a message ever. Do you know what I mean?
Well, first of all, I would be violating my ethical code and my screening guidelines. So then the question then becomes, am I engaging in malicious prosecution? If I ignore the law, and if I know that I don't have admissible evidence or likelihood of success at trial, but I use the authority of my office to engage in, then I will get sued as malicious prosecution in terms of abuse of my office as well, right? So I have to apply the law, and I have to meet with the ethical standards saying what meets that criteria. And then if I file charges without evidence for political purposes, it then delegitimizes the integrity of the system that we're trying to bring some sense of legitimacy or say that you can trust the system. And then finally, when I do want to raise the issue of reform, then the criticism will be, one, I don't know the law, so you can't trust what I say. And two, the process that I engage is already biased and therefore flawed. And then we would delegitimize what we have been trying to do, which is to bring the unvarnished truth to the community of citizens. People take for granted that I publish these reports. People take for granted that I go through the Q&A till exhaustion, till the reporters have nothing more to ask about anything that we have. That's not what used to happen. We did that with a commitment towards transparency and sharing that information. And we also knew that as we did so, it should make our community of citizens upset because it does not align with their moral expectations when the legal outcomes that they perceive do not align with those moral expectations. So if we want to have meaningful reform and change, then we have to be informed about the things that we want to change. If you simply think that the law is perfect, then I am not applying the law as it is. What I'm saying to our community is the law is not perfect. The law gives us certain kinds of outcomes, and if you want to change those outcomes, then you need to change the law.
And holding filing these reports, making them public, doing what you do is, as you said, something that hasn't been done before. It does make you the focus of, I think, a great deal of ire from people who want to see a different course of action. And I'm wondering if that makes you politically liable. And then I have a follow-up question about, you know, if you want to see the law changed, is something that you said. Do you want to see this particular statute change, the reasonable belief statute?
Well, I think that, look, last year I gave 22 proposals. My office could have given 100 of them. And we did it as an open letter to the governor and every elected legislator. And we purposely touched upon multiple areas if we want meaningful reform, everything from changing the law to the conditions in which you can actually use this particular safe harbor of justification to training issues and disclosure issues and sentinel events, etc. And the reason we went through that wide array was because this needs to be a systemic response for the kind of sustainable long-term change that we want to have. To go back to your first question, look, we've made a very conscious choice that I have an obligation to do a thorough job to let law enforcement and anybody who's an in-state institution know that we are committed to transparency and we will be subject of critical scrutiny and gaze. Simultaneously, that commitment for transparency also means that to our community of citizens, that I will bring you the unvarnished truth, regardless of what the expectation is or what the criticism to me personally or my institution or office will be as well. And that is because in order for us to actually make any kind of gain, we have to be informed about what is working and what is not working. And as I said at my last press conference, expecting a different outcome by doing the same thing is a definition of madness. And I have reviewed far too many shootings. Now, look, there are many circumstances in when both facts and the law coincide perfectly well, and the officer is doing what they're trained to do. There are other times what people are upset is maybe the scope and span of this law shouldn't cover all of these situations, but just some of these issues, and that's what reform is about.
So how do the people then make those reforms happen?
So I think the way you do it is you go to the legislature and you petition and you try to say, and I'm not saying favor one side disproportionately, I'm saying let's equalize that. And if the legislator, if there is not political will to take seriously the voice of our community, then you need to change the legislators, right? This is a political conversation. This is a policy conversation. And in a participatory democracy, it is about building that consensus. And there are people who think that police do nothing wrong. There's other people who believe that police do everything wrong. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. It is an inherently dangerous function which derives its powers from its citizens, and as such, it is not unreasonable for citizens to say that this is our expectation. And when we change the law, will there be officers who will grumble and disagree and protest? Yes, but ultimately they will rise to the standard of expectation we give to them. But if we do not change the law, then we should not be upset when they are within the confines of that law, the scope and span of which is really a wide net that it cuts.
I know we're running low on time here, but I'm wondering about the people who are a bit disheartened or jaded about the potential of affecting change in the law. I mean, you said if we don't change the law, then we can't expect different outcomes. A lot of people who want to see the law change don't think that it can be changed. Do you think that it really can be changed, Sunil?
I think it can be changed. Look, I believe in our participatory democracy, but that does not absolve me from pointing out where this is failing. It does not absolve me from having a truthful conversation. Even in the Breinholt matter, I said, okay, now if I take my DA hat off, I can tell this was a preventable death, right? So what is the nature of our contact with people who are in a state of crisis? What is our process and procedure when we take custody of that person? What is our moral and legal responsibility for duty of care to that person? If we know that somebody who is intoxicated and in a state of crisis, expecting them to behave in a rational way in itself is an irrational expectation. If I'm going to hold somebody for a period of time in a state of crisis or intoxication, I expect them to be uncooperative, combative. And what measures have I taken in order to address that issue? Is it appropriate for me to have a gun on my thigh in that setting and to present that? Or would it be more prudent to have a simple bar that runs back there that I can clip the person if they're handcuffed so they can't harm me or harm themselves? And maybe I check in my weapon at the time of booking so it's not there because I know I'm going to be there, right? These are all valid issues that would have and could in the future have an impact on the outcome of this interaction.
Sure, and lead to something less tragic. I'm just going back to that exact incident. I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that Sergeant Longman had the wherewithal to say the words, "You're going to die, my friend," to this man before shooting him. And that makes it seem like officers were very much in control of the situation. It makes the whole thing feel like an execution. Was that statement, that exact statement, "You're about to die, my friend," was that not part of the legal determination as to whether or not this was justified?
Yeah, absolutely. As I shared at my conference, I go, when I first saw that video on his proper speed and the way quickly it happens, I was also shocked, angry, and taken aback by this because I thought that was a reprehensible statement that was made. It's an unforgivable statement to be made. But when we went through it from multiple videos, slowed it down, here's what it revealed. One, because initially I thought, just like everybody else, that this ruckus happens in there. Officer Longman's outside. He unholsters his gun. He rushes in, points it at this person's head, and executes him, and uttering those infamous words. When we went through it, here's what we factually determined. One, he had his gun holstered when he entered in there. He did not unholster his weapon. In fact, he actually went to less lethal and punched him several times in the head, trying to get his hand released. And then when I slowed it down, then he starts to utter those infamous words, "You're about to die, my friend." And then as he's reaching for his weapon, pulls the weapon out. So he starts to actually utter those and utters those words before pointing the gun at this person's, at Chad's head. And I know these are subtleties, but context is everything. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not here to defend his words, nor would I ever defend those such words. But I have a responsibility to factually contextualize everything that's there. And when we went through that analysis, it paints a very different picture, because if you say those words before you pull the gun out or as you're pulling the gun out, it is ostensibly a warning. If you say it after you pull that and point it to somebody's head and say that, it can be an execution. So that is sort of our job to sift through that. And my job is to bring that uncomfortable truth of what happened, to reconstruct what happened. I don't have one way from a political perspective or a philosophical perspective to try to make one point. I have to start with the facts that are there and then say, what is the applicable law to it? But that does not mean that we as a community of citizens cannot be critical about how we got here. But at the same time, we have to recognize what the limitations that the law imposes in our ability to hold that person criminally accountable.
There are people, you know, on the neighborhood app next door who say things like, we're going to now get Sim Gill out of office. This is too far. He's justified this shooting and, you know, we should get him out of there. What do you say to that? I mean, are there prosecutors who could do something differently than the way that you're doing it?
Well, look, first of all, I believe that this is a office that is my privilege through the generosity of our citizens. And if they say that they're done with me, then that's our process, okay? But at the same time, my job is to bring that uncomfortable truth and to talk about systemic, sustainable reform and to have the honest conversation about it. And so I'll sort of pose this question. I don't know if you know who Wesley Bell is.
No.
Wesley Bell is an African-American public defender, defense attorney, who ran in Ferguson after the Michael Brown shooting on the platform of reopening and reinvest and filing criminal charges. And that's why he ran. And when he went there and got elected, opened the investigation, went back through it, and had a press conference, said, I cannot prosecute this because the law won't allow me to. It is not about filing charges. It's about being able to win those cases, to be able to hold people accountable in a meaningful way so it serves as a deterrent to that kind of conduct, right? But right now, our laws are overly generous. And so it's not about simply filing charges. And anybody who comes after me, or whenever they come after me, is going to run into the same impediment. And you can file them, but you're going to get them thrown out of court, or you're going to get sued for malicious prosecution. So it's about having that honest conversation. And that is what I'm committed to. But even if they get rid of me, that's not going to change the law. The change in the law is going to give us the results that we want.
Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and go through this with us today.
Thank you. It's always a privilege.
That's all the time we have for on In the Hive today, but we welcome your thoughts. You can email them to comments@kcpw.org or respond to the show on KCPW's social media. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.